I'm Jordan Abel, Director of Public Programs at the Jewish Community Center of San Francisco, and I welcome you to BINA, KALW's program featuring creative voices from the JCCSF. In this series, we bring you remarkable artists and thinkers who've come to speak at the JCCSF as part of our Arts and Ideas program. On this edition of BINA, our guest is feminist artist, author, and educator Judy Chicago. She's joined in conversation by writer and sociologist Sarah Thornton. And now, join me on stage at the JCCSF as I introduce Judy Chicago and Sarah Thornton. We are so happy you are all with us tonight for a wonderful program with the incredible Judy Chicago and Sarah Thornton. And I want to thank first the Jessica Silverman Gallery for partnering with us on tonight's program. Yay. Judy Chicago's Pussies, a solo exhibition of paintings, drawings, and ceramic plates made between 1968 and 2004, which explore women's agency, sexuality, and feline companions, is on view at the Jessica Silverman Gallery until October 28th. So if you haven't had a chance to visit the gallery to see it, please do so. And believe it or not, this is Judy's first solo show in San Francisco since the dinner party began its world tour at SF MoMA in 1979. For over five decades, Judy has remained steadfast in her commitment to the power of art as a vehicle for intellectual transformation and social change, and to women's right to engage in the highest level of art production. As a result, she has become a symbol for people everywhere, known and respected as an artist, writer, teacher, feminist, and humanist whose work and life are models for an enlarged definition of art, an expanded role for the artist, and women's right to freedom of expression. To say that Judy Chicago has made a significant contribution to art history is an understatement. She is one of the most important artists of her generation. Her courage and originality have fostered a powerful and distinctive oeuvre as she pioneered feminist art through her groundbreaking program for women at Cal State Fresno in the early 70s, to her most well-known work, The Dinner Party, which involved hundreds of volunteers and has been seen by more than 1 million people in 16 exhibitions across six countries, to other projects examining the Holocaust, power and powerlessness, birth and creation, and so much more. With a new generation of women committed to reinvigorating the feminist movement, the wisdom and relevance of her work is impossible to ignore. Judy's work is in museums around the world, including the British Museum, the Metropolitan Museum of Art, the National Gallery, SF MoMA, and many more, including over 25 university art museums. Recently, her work has exhibited in various thematic group shows, such as Pacific Standard Time, Made in LA, and The World Goes Pop at Tate Modern. She has two solo exhibitions currently on, in addition to the Jessica Silverman Gallery exhibition, on display right now inside the Dinner Party Studio at the National Museum of Women in the Arts and Roots of the Dinner Party, History in the Making at the Brooklyn Museum. And she lives and works in Belen, New Mexico. Judy is joined in conversation tonight by Dr. Sarah Thornton, writer, ethnographer, and sociologist of art, who was described by the Washington Post as the Jane Goodall of the art world. Please join me to welcome Judy Chicago and Sarah Thornton.
Hi.
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 It is a great honor to be on stage with a living legend and one of the most important artists of our time. And we're going to talk about Pussy Power. And so what I thought we'd do to start off, I'm very interested, Judy, in what the word pussy means to you and what it's meant over the years. You graduated from UCLA with an MFA in 1964. I assume the word pussy meant something, one thing then. In 1979, you showed the dinner party here at SF MoMA. And now, of course, we have a president who's kind of the grabber by the pussy president. And, you know, the Women's March in January was populated by people wearing pussy hats, male and female. And so, what does the word pussy mean to you? And what has it meant? How has it changed for you?
In the 60s, when I came out of graduate school into the LA art scene, which was singularly inhospitable to women, I used to hang out with the Ferris Boys, much to their consternation. For those of you who don't know who the Ferris Boys, Ferris Gallery in L.A. in the 60s was the most important gallery in Southern California. And it was full of guys who had a propensity to do ads, like Billy Al Bankson with his motorcycle, Kenny Price on a surfboard, Larry Bell with a cigar. And they used to hang out at a place called Barney's Beanery, and I would hang out with them. And if they wanted to put each other down, they called each other pussy. Don't be a pussy. So I got a clear message that being a pussy was not a good thing. But the problem was, what do you do if you have one? So imagine my delight that we now live at a time where I was telling Sarah, I do Instagram. It's the only social media I really like because I feel like I can like post things of meaning. And so, you know, people follow me. And like one of my followers is something called Club Clitoris. And another is Vagina China. And I'm like, well, you know, I was there first.
Yes, the godmother of Vagina China.
So it's a pleasure to be able to do a talk called Pussy Power or have a show called Judy Chicago's Pussies. It's a pleasure. And the hell with you, Ferris Boys.
Yes, we can reclaim it now.
Yes, we can reclaim it, absolutely.
So then the other word in tonight's title is power. And what does power mean to you?
Well, power has meant different things to me at different points in my career. In my early work, I stopped trying to be a boy in order to fit into the LA art scene and decided to be myself as an artist. I struggled with social definitions of female power as negative and tried to overcome that in my studio. Because after all, what is an artist without creative power? One of the problems for women artists, I think even today, is if we look at what happened to Hillary Clinton, we see that still society has a great deal of difficulty dealing with powerful women. And if you're alone in your studio and you're afraid of your own power, then you can't really fully express yourself. So once I like struggled through my own anxieties in my studio, I began to look back in history to see about how if there had been powerful women in the past and important women, because in the 60s, people used to say, women had never didn't have a history. This is before women's studies, before any widespread understanding that our history has been erased. And so then I was interested in trying to restore the power to women that had been erased in history, which is part of why I did the dinner party. And then I was interested in the power of birth, which I did actually in the Bay Area. I did a whole series of images on birth in Benicia. And I used to say in response to the idea of women being powerless, if everybody had to see the vulva giving birth, the idea of women being powerless would completely disappear. In the 80s, I did this series called Power Play, which is going to be shown in New York again in January. It was an examination of the construct of masculinity before the advent of queer theory or masculinity studies. And as usual, I started in the library, and when I looked up gender, the only books that came up were about women, as if only women had gender. So I was then interested in the way in which power has affected men and the way their power has affected the world. I think power and powerlessness have been major currents in my work. Of course, then my husband, photographer Donald Woodman, and I did an 8-year project on the Holocaust, and you could say that the Nazis exemplified, up until that point in time, the most grotesque use of power. And most recently, I finished a project that looks at the powerlessness of other creatures in the face of human power.
So, tell us, what's a nice Jewish girl doing with a name like Chicago?
Well, like...
You were Cohen, and from a long line of rabbis.
Yes, I was born...
23 generations.
23 generations, up until my father, who broke away and eschewed all things Jewish, was a Marxist and a labor organizer. And when Donald and I were doing research on the Holocaust Project, I was telling a rabbi who, because we consulted a lot of scholars and a lot of people in and out of the Jewish community before we started even making any art, I was telling him about, you know, my lineage back to the Vilna Gaon. And my father, and he said, "That's all right. Moses was the first labor organizer." But, okay, so I got to L.A. when I was 17 to go to UCLA, and from Chicago, and I brought this incredible Chicago accent. I had a proto-feminist consciousness, and so I kept my maiden name even when I married my first husband, Jerry Garowitz. But then I noticed that there were a lot of Cohens showing.
Yes.
So I decided to use his name, and which was more unique. So the thing is that when I was in my first gallery, Ralph Nelson Gallery, it was a time in L.A. that a lot of artists had underground names. And my first dealer used to call me Judy Chicago because I had such a strong Chicago accent. And, like, I don't know if you know who Ed Roche is, but he was Eddie Russia, and Larry Bell was Ben Lux, and we all listed our names in the phone book under our underground names. It was like a thing. So then my first husband died. I was 23 years old. And people would come up to me and say, "I knew your parents." But they weren't my parents. They were Jerry's parents. So I felt like I didn't have a name. When, at the end of the 60s, I decided to make a radical change in my art making and be myself as a woman and try and figure out how to create a feminist art practice and also how to develop a form of art education that was more appropriate for young women, where they didn't have to do what I had had to do, which was to eschew any indication of gender in my work. I wanted to make a public statement about the fact that I was changing directions. Also, the early days of the women's movement, we didn't really have our own forms, and we kind of borrowed from the Black Panthers and stuff, you know, so it was like really radical. Took out an ad, an art form, changed my name. But the thing is that it became my name, and it became symbolic of what I was setting out to do. But here's the thing. Do you know the stupidest thing that anybody ever wrote about me?
I'm sure there's a lot of really
stupid
stuff written.
There is a lot of stupid writing.
So what's the stupidest?
The stupidest thing that somebody wrote was that I changed my name to Judy Chicago so my initials would be J.C.
And this was just their supposition.
This was their supposition. They didn't bother to go back and find out what my name was, except for my initials were, except for that very narrow window of time when I mistakenly used my first.
You were
always JC. Right.
And here, the Art Forum ad, in which Judy declares that she's renouncing patriarchy and taking on a name of her choosing rather than those of her late husband and at that point, late father.
Yes.
I just love the boxer image.
Yeah,
you are very much a fighter.
Yeah. But, you know, this is how myth happens, okay? The story of the boxing ring ad, I had a dealer named Jack Glenn whose family in Kansas City made their fortune by developing the system of putting names on, like, bowling shirts. And, you know, I told you about how all the Ferris boys, you know, like, did these macho posters for their shows, the studs and this and that. And so
They actually did have a group show, those boys, called the Studs.
So Jack came up with this idea for an announcement, and I thought it was hilarious because it was like a takeoff of the boys, right? Well, what happened was that Art Forum was in L.A. then, and the editor of Art Forum tried to get Jack Glenn to run the ad as full page, and Jack didn't want to pay for it. And so it was just a mailer. So Phil Eder published it as a full-page ad in Art Forum for nothing. And it was right when women artists around the country were really getting pissed off at the sexism in the art world. And so it became like this kind of mythic thing, you know. And so, I mean, I would visit women artist studios, would be up on their walls, and I would meet male artists. They say, "You want a box?" Like, I'm like, I mean, I was like, so not this.
Good on Phil Leader for giving you a free ad. I never knew that. That's awesome. Let's now go back a couple of years to your geometric phase when you're working with color and shape and exploring a kind of minimal aesthetic, but seeming to satirize it with titles like Three Star from 1969 and A Study for Whirling Donuts, 1968.
In 1965, I would not have called that drawing Three Star. I mean, by the time 1969 came around, I was already starting to make this radical change. And also, I knew that there was a lot of hidden content in this work, which, you know, you've particularly written very movingly about. At the time, it was not, people couldn't read this at all. They could not read it. Mm-hmm. And if they did read it, like, you know, I was doing these domes also at that time. If they did read it, it was like the reading Irving Blum from Ferris made of my domes when he called them, oh, yeah, the Venus of Willendorf, which was not, you know, exactly, it was not a compliment.
Interesting.
It was not a compliment. It was like, oh, this icky female stuff. Like, leaked in there.
And, of course, the Venus of Willendorf is actually kind of a pregnant figure.
Right.
And so he was associating the domes with the belly.
Right. And, you know, maternal, not exactly an image of a woman artist, right?
Yeah, yeah.
You're listening to feminist artist, author, and educator Judy Chicago, whose artwork is currently on exhibit at the Jessica Silverman Gallery at 488 Ellis Street in San Francisco until October 28th. She's joined in conversation by Sarah Thornton on Bina, a series featuring creative voices from the Jewish Community Center of San Francisco. Bina is also available as a podcast, and you can find it at kalw.org.
And then I've got up here social protest versus ambiguity, because I think that's a tension that a lot of artists experience. And sometimes people complain that there's too much ambiguity here and you're not like a hardcore feminist. And then other times for different work, you're too didactic and you're, you know, what's your feeling about that tension, that kind of classic antagonism between the two?
Well, I very deliberately resisted doing openly political work, because from the beginning, from the time I started studying art, as you know, at five, and you know, I always wanted to be an artist, I always wanted to make a contribution to art history, I wanted to become part of art history. It was one of my singular goal. And I wanted to make art that transcended the time in which I lived, as opposed to making art that was specifically linked to political times. And even, like, I even had a round with the Brooklyn Museum around the dinner party when they rehung the heritage panels that explicate the women on the floor in front before you saw the dinner party, and I made them take them down, because I said if I wanted to make a didactic piece, I would have made photo murals with text. I made a work of art that when you leave it, and if you're curious about the names on the floor, the heritage panels are there for you to investigate. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. But by putting them beforehand, it totally changes the experience.
Mm-hmm. So, Morning Fan, which you can see at Jessica Silverman Gallery, is a really awesomely beautiful, monumental painting.
It's big. It's 5 feet by 10 feet.
And you went to Autobody spray
school.
Paint school and were the only woman in a class of 300 men, 250 men, learning how to spray paint to make this kind of perfect painting, which is very sensual and seems to have kind of some pent-up sexual desire in it, and even has that kind of vanishing central core for which you're famous. And I was wondering if you could tell us a little bit about making this work in Fresno.
Yeah, I was... this is from a series called Fresno Fans, and I did two series while I was there. That was the year I started the first feminist art program. And one of my goals, as I said before, in starting that program was to help young women become professional artists without having to deny their gender as women, which I had had to do in my education. You know, my professors, my male professors, made it very clear that they didn't want any gendered imagery in front of their face. And, you know, so even though I was making this radical departure, I had built a language already in the first decade of my career. I had done a lot of work on color. I had built sort of the formal building blocks of my career. And so even though I was giving permission to my students to openly express themselves as women and to work with whatever materials they were comfortable with, I, in a way, had already distanced myself, and I was trying to find my way back and to bring together my formal language with my real content. But you want to know something, you know, again, I've been talking about this because this work was in storage for a really long time. It wasn't until the Getty Pacific Standard Time that brought attention to all this early work. And at the time, nobody could read the content of this work. But here's an amazing story. In Pacific Standard Time, one of the paintings in the other series from the Flesh Gardens was in the Getty show, and some of my male peers objected to it. Not minimal enough.
Amazing.
Too sensual.
Yeah.
So
not conceptual and dry enough.
Right. Yeah. So even in 2011 and 12,
they're still clinging on to an old aesthetic and alibi.
Yeah, and but they at least, you know, so now they saw it, but it was unacceptable.
Amazing. Well, thank God younger generations of artists and art critics and curators look at things differently.
Yeah, that's what happened, actually. And it was just blew me away that people started reading this work.
Yeah. Well, and I think it is not hard to understand how the dinner party changed people's consciousness. And, you know, you look at the careers of people like Louise Bourgeois. She did not really have a major show in New York until 1981. After this, and it was of that decades of work that had been ignored. And I think that maternity and motherhood is a huge theme in Bourgeois' work, you know?
Yes.
And it was really beyond the pale and not acceptable within the canons of contemporary art or even art history until after we looked at a lot of vagina china.
Well, the dinner party, of course, was in New York in 1980 at Brooklyn.
And
at the Brooklyn Museum. But I just want to make a quick segue about the subject of motherhood and maternity, because when I was working on the Birth Project, you know, Frida Kahlo wasn't that well known then, and her My Birth painting was not well known. And I actually thought there were no images of birth in Western art and contemporary art. And like 2 years ago, there was a show in Milan curated by Massimiliano Gioni, who's the head curator at the new museum, called The Great Mother. And it was an unbelievable show. I discovered, because, you know, I knew all about, from doing all the historic research that underpins the dinner party, I knew all about the erasure of women's achievements from history. What I didn't know was there was a whole other form of erasure that had to do with subject matter, you just touched on it, that has not been considered important because it's what women do. There is a huge amount of work on the subject of birth.
Interesting.
Huge. It just blew me completely away. Okay. I'm just going to assume that everybody knows what the dinner party is. Okay.
It is on permanent display at the Brooklyn Museum of Art.
Right.
And next time you're in New York, you must pay homage. Make a pilgrimage.
This is from the old San Francisco Museum installation in 1979, where the dinner party premiered, where it was a huge, huge success. The bookstore sold 100,000 people saw it. There were five-hour lines. Karen Finley started her career there doing a piece called The Cocktail Party, honoring 39 gay men, and they were honored by gay men on roller skates who presented their honor on paper plates. So, like, Vidal Sassoon was a hairdryer on a paper plate. Anyway, the bookstore made so much money that they bought a computerized cash register they called Judy. But anyway.
Beautiful.
Anyway, so the piece was installed. It was, you know, the press preview. There was a huge amount of media. And a Life magazine photographer came to photograph the piece. Number one, he wanted me to get in the middle of it, and I said no. And he said, Life magazine might not reproduce it, and I'm like, you know what? I'll live without Life magazine. Anyway, but the thing is there were rafters above in the rotunda,
yeah,
like a walk space, And he weighed 300 pounds, the photographer. And the museum made him sign a waiver saying that if he fell down on the floor, on the heritage floor, and broke it, they would be liable for the entire cost of the whole dinner party.
It's hysterical.
I thought it was so funny. And here we are in San Francisco, so isn't it fitting?
It is fantastic. It's marvelous to see Judy's drawings of and studies for the plates. And there is a beautiful color drawing for Judith, the place setting. And, of course, you are Judith.
Yes, I am.
And I'm just wondering if this is a self-portrait.
No. I mean, first of all, I told you my father eschewed all things Jewish. You know, I grew up I grew up in a secular Jewish household. You know, it was only when Donald and I embarked on the Holocaust Project that both of us grew up in the same kind of household. So I didn't have a lot of Jewish consciousness. I didn't know anything about Jewish history. But the dinner party what I set out to do was to tell the story of the history of Western civilization is. We all had learned it through a series of heroes representing different times. So I had to have somebody to represent the development.
She saved Israel.
Right.
Yeah, by cutting off the head of
Holofernes.
Thanks for pronouncing that for me.
Yes. So, you know, she's a great Jewish heroine. So yeah. I thought she would, you know, so it's like, okay, there was Moses in history, and there's Judith in her story.
Yeah. Yeah, and she's got a knife coming out of her big J.
Well, that, of course, is to cut. It's a reference to Holofernes. And actually, the Hebrew that goes down the side says, Judith, heroine of her people.
In the show, in the Tenderloin, there are three test plates, which are all related to this one. And I may mispronounce this.
Rosvita.
Oh, Rosvita, a medieval nun, poet, and playwright.
Unclear if she was actually a nun. It was a period in time when women, where the convent actually became a place, an alternative to women who may not have wanted to marry and lose their fortunes, for
example. Also to be educated.
And to be educated and to be able to practice, in her case, writing. Mm-hmm. Her abbess supported her. Mm-hmm. Not clear if she ever took vows. She did, in fact, live in a convent.
Okay. I mean, I actually am completely captivated by this idea of representing women through these vaginas, actually.
Well, but
because they're so different and they're so expressive, and you've used this biomorphic challenge to represent the whole social and historical aspect of a woman through these means.
Well, you know, there's going to be the show that opens next month at the Brooklyn Museum called Roots of the Dinner Party: History in the Making, which will be the first actual look after 40 years at my creative process and doing the dinner party. And I hope that there will also be, I think, some new iconographic reading. Okay, so let's do an iconographic reading. First of all, as I've said to people, but it seems not to have, like, connected, there is a point, making vaginal references in the dinner party had a point. There are 39 women represented at the dinner party table across century, across country, religion, profession, geography. The only thing they have basically in common, and the reason they're not known, is they had vaginas. So that there's a point to that. Mm-hmm. To the imagery, along with the idea of challenging the notion that the phallus is universal and the vagina is something
specific.
Right. So I also was trying to build a new kind of language, visual language. But as the dinner party as the work, as the years went by and the dinner party, and I began to develop the images, and after I wanted them to become dimensional as a way of talking about the rise and fall of women's history, that there, it's like, you know, everybody says, like, now is, oh, women artists are so much, you know, that's a great period for women artists. There have been other periods that have been great for women artists, and then they've been completely erased again. So the change in dimension in the plates chronicles that rise and fall mm-hmm. through history. And then I got interested, particularly after I started designing the needlework runners, which tell something about the lives and create the context for the plate. I started incorporating iconography, needle techniques from the period. So the Rosvita plate sits on a runner that's done in a technique called Opus Teutonicum, which was the type of needlework that was done in Germany at the time she lived. And the imagery on the plate, you're absolutely right, that's a nun's cap. And the monasteries...
Fairly virginal.
Yeah, well, they... I mean, yeah, well, right.
I love that about her, actually. And it's quite a pristine plate, I'd say.
And also the hand, that praying hands.
Yeah.
Actually, this is sort of funny. You know, nobody ever got any jokes in the dinner party. There are a lot of jokes, visual jokes.
So many.
This is one.
It's so witty.
At this time in the monasteries, you know, people didn't have bathrooms. You know, they had outhouses, you know. I mean, and in the monastery, on the sides of the monasteries, there were, like, stalls for people, for the populace. And the nuns used to walk through the center courtyard. This is, again, how mythology happens. And they would have their hands and they'd have their head down so as not to intrude and see people peeing. And that became associated with piety.
Amazing.
So that's the gesture she's making.
Yeah. And then here we're going to start talking about cats. And the first time you pun on the word pussy is when you do potent pussy homage to Lamont, and Lamont was
my cat who died. Lamont Cranston. He was named after. When I was growing up, I used to listen to radio shows with my father, and the one I liked the best was the. Lead character was named Lamont Cranston. It was called The Shadow. What evil lurks in the hearts of men? The shadow knows. I remember from when I was a little girl.
And Lamont was a black cat.
Yes, he was a black cat. Actually, it was really interesting when Jessica and I were, you know, working on what to show, and she wanted to show this series called Kitty City, and I'm like, you know, people aren't going to have any context for it in the Bay Area. I haven't had a show since the dinner party. You know, where? How did she get from the dinner party to Kitty City? And so we started looking at my flat files, and we realized that this overlap between pussies and pussies goes back a long time.
Yeah. Yeah. Amazing. So what are your theories about the association between femininity and femininity?
Well,
why the pussy thing?
I mean, when I started Kitty City, you know, I was investigating, like, of course, the history of cats. I wanted to do this series based on a medieval Book of Hours, kind of a day in the lifetime of our house. And it was probably one of... it was an exploration into human-animal relationship, which I've continued looking at since then. And so in my research, of course, historically there's an association between women and cats dating back to the Inquisition, where actually it's horrible. The Inquisition targeted cats. They instructed people to burn them alive, skin them, flay them, particularly black cats, because they were considered familiars of witches. And also there's been association between vanity and women and, you know, pussies. And these little watercolors are actually, I did specifically for the introduction to Kitty City, for the page introduction, because it is, it's an illuminated manuscript, like a historic image, a beckoning cat, or a cat gazing into the mirror. I mean, they draw on historic images.
Mm-hmm. This is Bina, KALW series featuring artists and thinkers who've spoken at the Jewish Community Center of San Francisco. Today's program features feminist artist, author, and educator Judy Chicago, whose artwork is currently on exhibit at the Jessica Silverman Gallery at 488 Ellis Street in San Francisco until October 28th. She's joined in conversation by Sarah Thornton. Bina is also available as a podcast, and you can find it at kalw.org.
I'm a cat lady, and I'm actually going to demonstrate my cat ladiness, because test me on this. These are Judy's cats from this period in the early 2000s, and I believe we have Pete and Repeat on the ottoman. Inca is the black one, Trio's the ginger, Milagro, named by Donald, and that's Romeo.
That's Romeo.
And that is
Veronica.
And she's kind of already deceased in
They're
this
all,
picture.
The only cat that's... No, she died while
she died,
I was doing
but
Kitty
that why
City.
She's kind of drawn in a different way.
Yeah,
she's the ghost of Veronica is up on the top of the chair.
Yes, that's right.
So tell us what's going on here, because it is a book of hours and it is documentation. It's interesting, you did the Birth Project and you've represented women in different ways. This is really a representation of family.
Well, it's also about the something everybody knows if they're close to their companion animals, is that human beings are not the only creatures that individuate.
Yeah.
You know, like our cat sitters always used to complain because they couldn't keep track the different cat treats that they had to give. If we traveled, they'd have to feed the cats and give them treats because they all like different treats. You know, just like people, they had their own tastes.
Yeah.
And so, I mean, Kitty City is like an exploration of our relationship with the cats, their relationships with each other, what they do all day. I had, you know, because like David Hockney has done a lot of drawings of his dogs. But they're usually sleeping because, you know, I mean, animals really don't pose, especially not cats, unless they're asleep. So, like, I had to get up in the middle of the night. I had no idea what they did at 2 in the morning. And since I was chronically a day in the life of our household, you know, I found out what they play at 2. They carried on at 2 in the morning. We're sleeping. You know, then at 6 in the morning, they'd all come in and say, wake up, wake up. So, I mean, Kitty City chronicles a day in the life of our household. And it's about, I guess it is about family. Of course it's about family.
They're very loving. Yeah.
And, you know, the other thing I think is that I think I was trying to suggest that we have a very limited and often horribly exploitative relationship with most of the creatures on the planet. We look at them as being there for us. And I think I was trying to introduce the individuality of our cats as a way of introducing discourse about other species and the right of other species to live their species' lives independent of us. Something, a theme that, as I said, I've come back to in my most recent project.
Because you have a whole history of working with having a different attitude towards nature and being very critical of the male earthworks, let's say, that would bulldoze and damage environments. And when you did your smoke pieces, let's say, And Judy did one of her smoke pieces at SF MoMA back in April, I believe. But you've also done them out in broader natural environments.
Yeah.
It would seem that that is all kind of part of the same impetus of, not wanting to be destructive, being respectful of nature of all kinds.
Well, see, I mean, that's, for me, feminism, being a feminist, is about having a different point of view. And being a feminist artist is not just about making images of women. It's about bringing a different philosophy to bear on how we live our lives, how we interact with each other, how we treat the planet, how we treat other creatures, bringing respect and making space for every voice. It's an upending of the values of the world in which we live.
On that note, Judy would love comments, questions.
Hello, my name is Miriam Menzel. I want to ask you something that's different from everything you've talked about tonight, which is your merger poem, which I was wondering, I heard about it through liturgy in synagogue, and I'm wondering whether that was your intention or something you had in mind when you wrote it, or was it a surprise to you that it has
got incorporated into liturgy?
Yes.
Yeah, it was a huge surprise. In fact, actually, somebody told me that they didn't have any idea I was an artist. They thought I was a poet because they had encountered the merger poem in liturgy. It's not just Jewish liturgy either. It's across religions, which is interesting. I wrote the merger poem when I was working on the dinner party. And actually, it reflects the underpinnings of the dinner party, and some of the phrases are on the banners that introduce the dinner party. It's, for those of you who don't know it, it's a visionary poem about transforming the world. And, of course, when Donald and I did all of our research for the Holocaust Project and on our history as Jews, I realized that long before I developed Jewish consciousness, I already was infused with the values of Tikkun Olam from the family I grew up in. And I would say that poem reflects those values.
Judy.
Where are you?
I'm over here.
Oh,
Judy.
Oh, over there. Hi. Who are you?
Juan Espinoza from UCLA.
Oh, really? Hi.
Hi, Judy.
We went to school together.
Judy, I was curious, in reading, when you talked about your cats, and when I read Rilke and Yeats and some of the other poets, they talk about different powers, and I wondered, do you get some powers from your cats? Do they talk to you to help you, or to somehow give you a certain way of looking at your work? The cats, the power of the energy of the cats?
One of the images in Kitty City is take your cats to work when they sit on my drawings. Is that what you mean?
No,
I know, I'm teasing.
Not at all.
I'm teasing you, Juan.
Okay.
What have you been doing all these years?
Well, we'll talk about that. I'll go backstage. But the other thing I was so very, very curious about, when you did the dining room? What was that? What was the year you did a dinner party?
Between 1974 and 79.
Okay. We've come a long way since then. I wonder if you were to do the dinner party now, Judy, how would you differ it in terms of all women? Because now with all the gender divisions we have and how much we've changed since then, How would that
really
change?
Tell that to a woman in Pakistan or Afghanistan who's not allowed out of the house. Tell it to a woman in Africa who is disallowed any sexual pleasure. No, we are. Yes, in the United States, we have come a long way. But I don't, I mean, I see the story the dinner party tells is a much bigger story than us at this moment in time.
Hi, Judy. I'm Bianca Taylor. I saw I saw the dinner party in the Brooklyn Museum when I was there last summer, and it was really incredible.
Thank you.
My question is, what is something about the art world today that makes you hopeful?
What is it about the art world now that makes me hopeful?
What is something? Can you think? Is there anything about the art world that makes you hopeful?
The fact that, you know, artists keep working in the face of all the challenges there are, and that ultimately the creative impulse can't be stopped. But I have a lot of criticisms of the art world now.
But she loves her dealers.
The next question is right here on the right.
Hi, I'm okay. Julie Mills.
Okay,
and
hi.
I'm wondering if when you were at UCLA as a student, if you faced pushback and discrimination from professors for trying to do feminist art there.
Well, there was no word feminist art then. You know, that word only was created in the 70s. So there was no word for female-centered work. And in fact, in 1965, when I was showing at Rolf Nelson in LA, he had a 24-foot cloud painting by Georgia O'Keeffe hanging in his gallery. It was for sale for $35,000, and there was no interest whatsoever. And did I face... I mean, I grew up in a family that believed in equal rights for women. I was very, very fortunate. The bad news is they forgot to tell me the rest of the world didn't go along with that. So I get to UCLA, and I'm this, like, ambitious young woman, and I minored in philosophy, and I'm sitting in a philosophy class, and I raise my hand to ask a question, and the professor does not call on me. He calls on every guy who's got his hand up, and I'm like waving my hand until I got so embarrassed that he had to call on me. Yes, and I got sexually harassed out of becoming a pyrotechnician by the guy who owned the fireworks company and the most important curator in Southern California saw a piece of mine in my studio in Pasadena that went on to become a legendary piece, and he refused to look at it. Why did he refuse to look at it? Well, Judy, he said, you have to understand, women in the 60s were either groupies or wives of artists. And what was I supposed to make of the fact that you were making art that was stronger than the men's? I had to avert my eyes. And he actually thought I would say, oh, Walter, I understand.
That was Walter Hopps?
Yes. That was Walter Hopps.
I'm Patty. I'm an alum from the California Institute of Integral Studies, which had the first woman's spirituality PhD. I love your work. I've used it in ritual, especially the part on all the witches, to create ritual to remember them. They're kind of my people. I'm always really impressed by the books you put out that go with all of your different art installations, so I'm looking forward to the next book. And I wonder what inspires you to do the books along with the projects.
I wrote my first book because of Anaïs Nin, the writer, the diarist. It was a time I was really struggling with the idea of could there be a female aesthetic, and if so, what that might look like. And she helped me a lot. And I had all these thoughts tumbling around in my mind, and she said, "You can't live through everything, but you can write through everything." Then I wrote about my work because nobody else would write about my work. Now I'm not writing about my work anymore because there are all these other people who are writing about my work.
Yeah. Hi, Judy. I'm Tanya Augsburg. So I'd like to just tell the audience that you were an inspiration for another exhibition, San Francisco, that came out last year, the You in the Most Loving Way show. And I just want to thank you because of your input, we were able to expand the show, and we had this piece called Revisiting Woman House, which was, I don't know if everyone knows, that Judy was the co-director of this historic exhibition called Woman House, Feminist Art Exhibition, which we didn't talk about today, but probably didn't have enough time. And so my question is really, what are your thoughts about education today for young women, and do you think it's getting better for them in terms of education, or are you inspired by it, or do you have some choice words, I'm sure you do, for the situation today?
I have no idea. I mean, I'd have to ask young women. Is it getting? How many young women are here? Raise your hand.
Quite a few, I think.
Yeah. So, are you happy with your education? Is it meeting your needs? If there are young women artists or women students, art students, are you getting what you need from the art school? What? Yes.
I was actually a feminist modern art history major.
Yeah, yeah.
So she was a feminist modern art history major. And so it's great you can be a feminist art history major.
Yes, actually. Actually, I interned at National Museum for Women in the Arts. So next time I'm home, I'll, you know, go visit it. I think one of the benefits of being a young woman today and having identity even expanding to include so many people is when you want to learn about yourself, which is so much of what art history is, so many schools, not as many as I would like, but so many schools are encouraging students to expand what they want to learn as a reflection of who they are as people. So you see these art departments encouraging feminist art history curriculums and queer identity and even masculine identity. And you know, they're very nurturing. I'm not going to lie. I've definitely experienced some pushback, but I can only hope it gets better as long as people, not just women, are angry and want to learn. My hope is schools will follow suit.
Hope that's true for everybody.
Well, thank you everyone for coming out today. And I think the word inspiration came up many, many times. And I have to say that you are an inspiration to me as well. And it's been a great pleasure to be on stage with you.
For me too, Sarah.
Bina is a co-production of the Jewish Community Center of San Francisco and KALW. For more information about programs at the JCCSF, you can visit jccsf.org. Today's guest was feminist artist, author, and educator Judy Chicago, whose artwork is currently on exhibit at the Jessica Silverman Gallery at 488 Ellis Street in San Francisco until October 28th. She was joined in conversation by Sarah Thornton. The recording engineers at the JCCSF are Ben Bernardi, Brandon Battaglia, Dan Folds, Alex Espelay, and Lincoln Andrews. David Kwan edits and produces the program, and Matt Martin is the executive producer. Our theme music is from the album Masada Rock by the Rashanim Trio, and the music you're hearing right now is by John Zorn. Bina is available as a podcast, and you can find it at kalw.org. I'm Jordan Abel. Thanks for listening.